On this week's 51%, we'll hear about a study on fat shaming.
Traditionally, at least in U.S. society, body image is something that's so intricately connected to the interpretation of women.
A woman tells a fat-shaming story about her friend, and around the November elections, we get a refresher about an icon of the women's suffrage movement. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Dr. Jason Seacat is an associate professor of psychology at Western New England University in Springfield, Massachusetts. His study, entitled A Daily Diary Assessment of Female Weight Stigmatization, was published in the Journal of Health Psychology. He studied 50 overweight or obese women recruited via the internet from the U.S. and abroad to complete week-long daily diaries.
There's been a long history over the last couple of decades beginning to look at weight-related stigmatization or shaming in society, but the vast majority of the studies have been looking at it and asking people to talk about things that may have happened 10, 15, 20 years in the past. And when I started looking at these data, I felt that, you know, they wouldn't necessarily be that accurate because I often don't remember what happens to me the day before, let alone 10, 15 years ago. And so I really sought to conduct a study that would look at things in real time as they're happening with women. One of the things that really struck me as most intriguing about the study was the high volume of events that were happening daily in women's lives. I anticipated that the rates of stigma would be higher because we are starting to hear more about it in society, but not to the degree of where some women are experiencing three or more events per day.
I looked at that it was like 3.0 something, right, when you did the mm-hmm. average. And I just thought of someone cutting me down for whatever reason, three times a day. Coming at it from different people in different circumstances and different contexts, that's a lot to bear.
It is a lot to bear, and it's really the way I tend to look at it, from my perspective, is that it's all in addition to the stuff that we already have to bear on a daily basis. So if you think about it, that, you know, we all face challenges and we face barriers in our daily lives that, you know, are associated with just living, and you add on these additional barriers, you know, associated with weight, it can make living daily life quite challenging for certain people. And more specifically, it can make dieting and exercise extremely difficult, if not impossible, for some people.
Well, sure, because you enter that vicious cycle, right? Where
exactly.
Who's giving you positive messages to break it? You know, actually quite mm-hmm. the opposite.
Yeah, it certainly does. As you mentioned, it becomes a vicious cycle that individuals, not only are they facing the barrier of, you know, trying to, you know, maintain a healthy weight or eat healthier in their life, they also then feel like they don't have anyone that is supporting them. So it conveys a lack of social support for these individuals.
What kind of stigmas were found? I'm sure they vary, but were there commonalities, and just define what these stigma events are?
Yeah, so we specifically looked at four different types of stigma. Three of them are more traditionally identified, and that is interpersonal stigma, so stigma between an overweight or obese person and others. Institutional stigma, so stigma that would come from things like your educational institution, a doctor's office, things like that. And then internalized stigma, which is more of a melding of the other forms of stigma, but the sense that you're being stigmatized by individuals. And then the fourth type of stigma we looked at were public barriers, so encountering things in daily living that challenged you, like not finding, you know, not being able to fit a seatbelt and having to ask for a lap band extension, or going into a store and not being able to find an outfit, that fits your specific size. And what we found was that interpersonal and internalized stigma were the most frequently encountered forms of stigma. So the internalized would suggest to me that even though, you know, I mean, people may or may not be, you know, stigmatizing an individual, these individuals are sensing that it's happening and it has an effect on them. And we know from the field of psychology that sometimes even more powerful than what is actually happening is what we think is happening to us. And that could largely be based on a pattern or a history of negative experiences, but that's definitely one area that needs further investigation. With regard to the interpersonal stigma, we found quite interestingly, and this is a finding that supports some of the existing research out there, in that the interpersonal stigma is tending to come from closer family members. People that an overweight or obese individual are close with, a parent or a spouse or even children, and that was a significant source of a lot of this stigmatization. However, we did find in the study, we had numerous women report unsolicited advice from complete strangers. You know, there was one particular example of a woman in a grocery store who was confronted by another individual and told, "You shouldn't be purchasing that. That's not going to help your figure." So there was definitely that aspect of unsolicited advice from strangers.
What do we do as a society? What do you do as a researcher going forward?
Yeah, so essentially, what I'm taking from this information, and the study in of itself has received a bit of attention and a lot of public response, is really thinking about how, I mean, it's really a three-part intervention that needs to occur. And thinking about, A, how we can empower overweight and obese individuals to be more resilient in the face of this discrimination. And there are some strategies within the field of, you know, social psychology that we can use to, and clinical psychology we can use to empower women to stand up in the face of this discrimination. But we also need to better educate the public. As you mentioned a little bit earlier, I feel like some of this stigmatization is not intended to be as such, you know, by family members or whoever is saying it. It's well-intentioned, but people need to be educated in terms of how to present a message so that they empower overweight and obese individuals rather than demotivate them by shaming them. And then the third part really comes from what I believe needs to be a more a policy approach within our country. Instead of blaming and shaming overweight individuals and focusing on, you know, all of the negative health events that are associated with it, focusing on attaining health and promoting programs that would lead to people improving their health and supporting those types of programs at the public level.
Is fat shaming a fair term?
Fat shaming, you know, it's interesting. When I first, published and was working on this study, I hadn't actually heard that term. And so it has come out a little bit more. And I do believe it is. I believe what it instills in these individuals is a sense of shame. And for all practical purposes, what we know in psychology is that shame typically does not lead to productive, healthy behavior on people's parts. It leads to either hiding or compensating or giving up altogether on one's goals, and shame really is not the appropriate way to approach individuals.
Why women? Why didn't you do men?
Clearly, in our society, men and women are pretty equivalently impacted by overweight and obesity. And probably even so with regard to stigma. I'm finding out more and more about stigma associated with men and overweight. But traditionally, at least in U.S. society, body image is something that's so intricately connected to the interpretation of women, whether it be, you know, as a spouse, as an employee in a company, and whether that's positive or negative, that's a reality. And so in choosing to look at women, it was on the basis of understanding that at least for this subset of our population, body image is made so important by society. And there are very demanding standards placed on women regarding body image. And so that's where I decided to go with it.
That was Dr. Jason Seacat, Associate Professor of Psychology at Western New England University in Springfield, Massachusetts, talking about his study on weight stigmatization. Meanwhile, writer Dr. Jerry Burns offers her view on weight stigmatization or fat shaming, suggesting that we take care when we share what's on our minds.
A doctor's waiting room is not a choice recreational vacation spot. It doesn't have high entertainment values, other than a droning television and piles of magazines describing diseases you never dreamed of having and are now terrified of getting. A doctor's waiting room is a neutral, nondescript place adorned with a motley collection of bored and nervous patients and coughing. A friend of mine recently went to the doctor, and as she sat in the waiting room, she distracted herself from her health concerns by checking social media. And she listened. It wasn't her intention to eavesdrop on a conversation, but the young woman sitting across the room was talking very loudly to an older patient. She wanted to be overheard. "Mom, obesity is a terrible thing, don't you think? I mean, those people are just asking for medical trouble." And then, "Mom, obesity and diabetes go together, don't they?" And still later, "Mom, don't you think that obese people should take better care of themselves? I mean, don't they know they're making themselves sick?" Like a politician on the stump, she bullhorned her philosophy about obesity and diabetes across the cluttered waiting room, and everyone there heard her. My friend, a plus-sized woman with a plus-sized personality, was convinced that those comments were aimed at her. She felt insulted and hurt. And now all of her friends are mad. We are mad at that young woman. We are mad that once again, weaponized words hurt a good person. A recent study by psychologist Jason Seacat and his colleagues suggests that overweight women are shamed like this multiple times every day. The study suggests that this is not only demeaning and painful, but it's counterproductive. Voicing negativity brings on more negativity. Who feels good after being shamed? No one. My friend was stigmatized because of her weight. As if it isn't already hard enough to be shamed by someone, this happened in a room full of people. She was exposed and violated. "That woman was so insensitive," my friend says. "It felt like I was being accused of a crime." And then she had to continue sitting there with the eyes of other patients looking at her, and also trying not to look at her, as if she was in the stocks. Whether you prefer to call this unfortunate social trend weight stigmatization or fat shaming, the person on the receiving end of such comments is hurt. Ironically, my friend was in a doctor's waiting room when she was wounded by the barbed words of the patient's daughter, and no one in that medical office could ease her pain. My friend understands that the woman's words were fed, in part, by genuine concern, but there were other things embedded in her dysfunctional method of delivery. The patient's daughter's words and tone were laced with the assumption that my friend is completely oblivious to the medical complications that can arise from weight. "Mom, doesn't she know that weight affects health?" My friend surely does. "Does the patient's daughter really think that I don't know that I'm overweight? Come on! I mean, I see myself every day in the mirror." And that's one reason why she's been working hard to change her lifestyle. Aware of the health risks of weight, she's been changing her eating habits. She clocks the hours spent at the gym and proudly shares the number of miles run on Facebook. She is losing weight and feeling better, slowly but surely, with a boatload of friends cheering for her every step on that treadmill. But the patient's daughter didn't know that part. All she saw was a person sitting in the doctor's waiting room. Without knowing anything about the whole person sitting there, the patient's daughter assumed her position and her assumptions. Then she attacked. And she was so wrong. Thankfully, the patient's daughter's hurtful words won't stop my friend. She is committed to having a healthier lifestyle, not because she was shamed into it by a stranger, but because she wants it from deep within herself. In our efforts to be caring, we risk pushing others into a pit of shame. Words are powerful, and the assumptions we make without knowing a person's whole story can be devastatingly wrong. So, instead of choosing words that inflict pain, we can choose words that bestow encouragement. And we must also remember that no words are often the best words of all.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com.
Oh, the day is not far off. Oh, we got trails, trails of trouble. And we got our roads, roads of a band. Hands of victory, we shall walk.
The outcome of the November elections will see some lawmakers reelected and others sent packing. And just how many women will be taking oaths of office, along with how many women honored their right to vote, will be tabulated. Susan Zimmet is founder of Votes for Women 2020, a nonprofit organization planning suffrage centennial events in 2017, when women secured the right to vote in New York, and in 2020, the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution granting women the right to vote.
Every November in America, all men and women age 18 and older have the opportunity to vote. That was not always the case. In 2020, the centennial of the woman's right to vote will be celebrated. The battle for this constitutional right was hard fought by the suffragists of the 19th century, who dedicated their lives to winning a right many women today take for granted. More than 100 years ago, Susan B. Anthony, one of the most renowned suffragist leaders, said in an address to the delegates of the National American Women's Suffrage Association the following: "We shall someday be heeded, and when we shall have our amendment to the Constitution of the United States, everybody will think it was always so. Just exactly as many young people believe that all the privileges, all the freedoms, all the enjoyments which women now possess always were hers. They have no idea how every single inch of ground that she stands upon today has been gained by the hard work of some little handful of women of the past. Domestic violence, equal pay for equal work, sexual harassment, and other issues women still face today were among the many issues our suffragette sisters faced also. However, without the right to vote, these women had no ability to impact the political process and create substantive change." In one of her many lectures on the subject of suffrage, Susan B. Anthony told a sold-out crowd, "The women of this nation must be awakened to a sense of their degradation, political, or at least we who are awake must make an effort to awaken those who are dead asleep." Susan B. Anthony was a woman of her word. She understood that one had to be willing to test the law to prove one's principles true. And test it she did. Early in November 1872, Anthony saw an ad encouraging voters to register for the upcoming presidential election in her local Rochester, New York paper. It read, "Now register. Today and tomorrow are the only opportunities. If you were not permitted to vote, you would fight for the right, undergo all privations for it, face death for it. Register now." Anthony decided this was the time to test the vote. With her three sisters and a dozen other women, she set out to register to vote. When they handed in the appropriate paperwork, the three male registrars were so befuddled, they actually allowed the women to register. It was a dangerous gambit. The law on the books at the time stated, "Any person who shall vote without having the legal right to vote shall be deemed guilty of a crime." The punishment was a fine of $500 and or imprisonment of up to 3 years. Anthony and her fellow suffragists showed up early on the morning of November 5th, 1872, and Anthony cast the only presidential vote of her life for Ulysses S. Grant. But the fun had just begun. During Thanksgiving dinner, a knock sounded on the door of the Anthony household. The U.S. Marshal, standing outside, gravely informed Anthony, "The commissioner wishes to arrest you." Susan demanded she be put in handcuffs. The marshal refused and escorted her to the commissioner's office. When the streetcar conductor asked for the 5-cent fare, Anthony said loudly enough for everyone to hear, "I'm traveling at the expense of the government. Ask him for the fare." In voting, Anthony had exercised what she believed to be her constitutional right, so she and her cohorts pleaded not guilty. Bail was set at $1,000 for Anthony and half that amount for the other women. But Susan B. Anthony was no amateur. For 3 weeks, she traveled the county asking audiences if it was a crime for a citizen of the United States to vote. Then on July 17, 1873, she was put on trial. Her crime? Voting. The jury of white men gathered before the huge audience to hear her case. Presiding over the trial was Judge Hunt. Anthony's was the first criminal case he had tried since his appointment. Unbeknownst to those in attendance, he had already penned his decision. The trial drew national attention. At the beginning, Anthony was ruled incompetent to testify on her own behalf because she was a woman. After the prosecution presented its case, Judge Hunt directed the jurors to find the defendant guilty and dismiss them. To the astonishment of all present, the judge pulled his already written decision from his pocket and found Anthony guilty and fined her $100. Anthony's reply was swift. "May it please your honor, I shall never pay a dollar of your unjust penalty." True to her word, she never paid the fine. Susan B. Anthony died many years before the ratification of the 19th Amendment granting women the right to vote in 1920. The woman who famously told her fellow suffragettes, "Failure is impossible," was proven right by the tireless dedication of many in her lifetime and after her death. As the nation approaches the 100th anniversary of the seminal moment in our country's history, many contemporary young women take the vote for granted. They have no sense of the sacrifice that women of a previous era went through to obtain the vote. And yet, the female vote is as important today as it was in the 1800s and the 1900s. Domestic violence, equal pay for equal work, sexual harassment, and other issues women faced 100 years ago, women still deal with today. However, we now have the right to vote. The founding mothers had no ability to impact the political process and create substantive change. We do through our vote. Unbelievably, in this day and age, some men still think politics is men's work. In March of 2014, Florida Representative Steve Sutherland held a men's only fundraiser. The invitation advised attendees to tell the missus not to wait up because the after-dinner whiskey and cigars will be smooth and the issues to discuss are many. In a subsequent article about the importance of voting, Cosmopolitan magazine told young women, "By showing up at the polls, you can remind politicians like Sutherland that it's past time to abandon the old boys' club mentality." The facts are sobering. White men make up just 32% of the U.S. population, but they make up 79% of the Senate and 75% of the House. Women comprise more than 50% of the population, but only 17% of Congress. If women do not vote, if women do not run, they cannot be heard. It was true for Susan B. Anthony in 1872. It is still true today. Votes for Women 2020 was formed to celebrate, educate, and inspire young women to exercise their hard-fought right to vote. Whoever wins in the 2014 elections will make laws related to the environment, the workplace, reproductive rights, education, college loans, internet freedom, the draft, and more. We need to embrace the power of the vote, to uplift every young boy and girl, every mother and father, every sister and brother. Susan B. Anthony understood that power. Do you?
That was Susan Zimmet, founder of Votes for Women 2020. She is also the town supervisor of New Paltz, New York. And that's our show for this week. We hope you join us for the next one. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1319.